Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM with me, Sean Delaney. Inside Education offers insights to educators on all aspects of teaching and learning. You can listen to or download over 340 podcasts of previous programmes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the Podcasts tab. On this week's programme, I interview an educator who is a blogger, an English teacher, and the director of inclusion in her school. She is also deputy head of Michaela Community School, a new free school that opened in 2014 in Wembley Park in London. Katie Ashford has spoken at national research and education conferences in the UK and has written for various websites and the Times Education Supplement. She's currently writing a book about education and special educational needs, and her blog is called Tabula Rasa. I met up with Katie a short while ago and spoke to her about several aspects of her work. I'll bring you my interview with her on the programme this week and next week. One of the topics that interests Katie is that of school culture. So when we met, I began our conversation by asking her to tell me what school culture is.
School culture is all about the feel of the school. It's about the day-to-day habits of the pupils and the teachers. It's actually, I think, quite hard to pin down. But I do think if you spend a day or two in a school, you get a sense of what the culture of a school is. And some schools have a very kind of academic culture, where pupils are really motivated and working really hard on their academic subjects. But other schools have more of a kind of sporty culture or more of a sort of creative culture. And some schools try to do both. And all of the small things, I think, that we do every single day, those are things that together sum up to create what is called a culture. I mean, it sounds quite a fairly sort of fluffy concept. It is difficult to pin down, but I do think you can try and sort of pick out the really small things that schools do every single day.
And where does this culture come from?
So I think it comes from the leaders of the school in the beginning. Those are the people that sort of set the culture, and the culture certainly filters down from them. But I do then think that the culture can only survive if it's reinforced by the staff, by the pupils, and to an extent by parents. Even though they aren't in the school building, they might actually contribute in some way to the culture as well, particularly when it comes to how hard children work and how motivated they are and so on. Parents play a huge role in that. So yeah, it certainly kind of starts from the top, but is upheld by everyone lower down in the organisation.
And for somebody who's in the school, whether they're a teacher or a student in the school, how do they notice the culture? How are they aware of it?
It's a bit of a cop-out answer, but I think it is in those small things. So, for example, the general sort of day-to-day behaviours. You know, I think one thing that's really nice about Michaela is that it's just part of the culture that children...
This is the school you teach in.
That's right, that's the school I teach at. One of the really nice things there is that it's just part of the culture of the school that everybody says good morning to each other. Everybody smiles when they see each other in the corridors. That is a very, very small thing, but that in itself has a huge impact on the overall feel of the school on a day-to-day basis.
I mean, I suppose what I'm thinking about is, you know, I might be in a school and I might think, oh, we have a really strong reputation for sport, or we have a really friendly atmosphere. But I may be mistaken, or I may not recognise it because I'm so invested in the place myself. So I'm just wondering, you know, does it take someone from outside coming in to look at a culture to really see it, or do the people who are there every day notice it or take it for granted? Sorry, that's a bit rambly, but...
Yeah. I think it's actually a slightly contradictory mixture of both, because there are certain things that you take for granted working in a particular culture. You know, you take for granted the good morning example. I have come to take that for granted a little bit, and that you just expect it all the time. But I suppose when you take those moments to look at the school and have a bit of perspective and think about it, then the culture is almost, it is something that you don't notice. It's because that's just part of the way that the organisation works. Yeah, but I think you notice it most when you are outside of that organisation, or when you speak to colleagues from other schools, or not necessarily schools, but other types of organisations. I have friends who work in law and in finance and so on and so forth, and when I speak to them about, you know, the various small things that we do day to day, that a lot of the stuff they will kind of say, oh, that's very different to the culture of where I work. So one really good example of that is that we kind of have a system among staff of trying to be very candid with each other and trying to be very open and honest all the time, because you don't want to get that situation where staff are kind of sitting in the staff room talking about the senior leaders or talking about another teacher that's got their back up or something. You don't want that situation, because that just kind of slows everything down. And when I speak to my friends who work in other professions about that, they're always really like, wow, that's amazing. I can't believe that you have that culture. And whilst I'm not trying to say that at Michaela we have got it perfect, of course, there's times when we don't get it right, that we really strive for that culture. And the fact that we do strive for that culture, whereas for a lot of organisations that's not even in on the agenda at all, is one of the things that helps to make the culture of the school a really nice place to work, actually.
When you say that people can, you know, talk openly, do you mean that people can criticise one another or be frank to one another? Is that it?
Yeah, that's right. So I wouldn't necessarily say criticism, because criticism has quite negative connotations. It's all about the intention behind giving somebody feedback. It's in the spirit of trying to help them improve. It's in the spirit of trying to help that individual improve, whether it's something about their teaching or, you know, a lesson observation feedback, or whether it's something, you know, we get a lot of stuff from staff about something that's not working in the school. And in fact, we have lots of systems in place to try and encourage that as much as possible. So one example is we have a system called error correction. So the idea is that staff, if they notice something in the school that's not quite working, and it can be something really small, like the clock in the break hall is 1 minute too slow, and that means that the teachers are dismissing late. Or it can be something huge, like actually I think behaviour on the sixth floor at changeover time is really problematic. We need more members of staff up there. Anything along those lines, staff are encouraged to pass those things up to the senior leadership team frequently, and in exchange they get a little gold star on a chart in the staff room. So it's kind of make it a little bit of a fun competition, and then at the end of term the person who's got the most gold stars gets a chocolate bar. And the thing is, it's really nice, because people then do, it gives them a reason to think, oh, actually, yeah, that's an error, I should pass that on to the senior team.
And this is for the teachers.
Yeah, this is just for teachers, exactly. And it's just a bit of fun, and we all have a laugh and a joke about it. But the fact is that on senior team we are kind of blind to what's happening on the daily basis in the school. You know, it's things like, you know, teachers are in the classroom. They're the ones that are at the board, asking the kids questions constantly and seeing how the kids respond and behave and so on and so forth. They're the ones that really know what's going on in the school. We can only know so much. So if we don't get that feedback from people who are at the chalk face every single day, then we're not going to be able to improve as an organisation. And I do think some organisations are a bit reluctant to do that, because they think, oh no, I don't want the little people telling me what to do and how to run my organisation. But like I say, the teachers, they are the ones that know most what's happening in the school. So you need to, if you're stupid if you don't listen to them, essentially.
Okay, but if we take something like the clock, say, being a minute slow or something like that, I mean, that's relatively safe. But supposing, for example, yeah. Say the standard of mathematics in a certain class is not as good as it should be, would it be as easy to raise those kinds of matters, which might reflect more on somebody's work rate and things like that?
That's a really good question. It is definitely very, very, very hard. But I think it's hard in every organisation. And I think that just by trying to create a culture of openness, honesty, candour, it does at least give somebody something to lean on. So we tend to say to members of staff, look, if you're really worried about having a candid conversation with somebody, because, I mean, even I get very nervous, you know, like your heart starts racing, you think, oh, God, you start sweating, oh, God, how's it going to go? But, you know, we give people, for example, phrases. You go into the conversation and say, look, in the spirit of candor, in the spirit of being candid, I just wanted to raise this with you. And because everybody's aware that we want to be open and we want to be honest, you kind of know, you mentally then go, right, okay, somebody's about to give me some candor. And you need to kind of say, please do give me this candor, because this will help me improve. It is very, very difficult, don't get me wrong. But I think if we don't encourage it as an organization, then it would be far worse. And I suppose there will be times when people are still, despite all of the things that we try and do to get people to be candid, they'll still find that too difficult. But the thing is, then I tend to believe that it will then manifest in other ways later on, that if they do think, let's say, your maths teaching is not up to scratch, you know, I mean, I'm an English teacher, somebody could, you know, a brand new teacher could come into my classroom to observe me, and because I'm more experienced, they might be thinking, oh, I can't possibly say to Katie that her teaching's not up to scratch. And I can understand why they'd find that really difficult. You know, I mean, I'm in a position of leadership at the school. That would be tough. But I suppose if somebody did come in and say, you know, to be really candid with you, I just want to talk to you about the lesson I saw. I mean, I would say, ooh, I'd probably feel a bit nervous, but I would try as hard as I possibly can to listen to what they're saying and take on board that feedback. And of course, you know, you can have a conversation, oh, actually, well, the reason I did that was because of this, or you didn't actually see that because you left the room before. And that's fine. You can always have a dialogue. But I also just think the more that it happens, the more that we encourage it, the better it is. But in terms of if that person, say, didn't have that conversation with me because they felt too scared to have it or whatever, then I do think that would manifest in other ways. You know, for example, with them, I don't know, perhaps my students would start to fail and things like that. And so actually, you'd want to get that feedback as quickly as possible. I think it's all about trying to, as much as possible, put your ego aside, which is, it goes against human nature, but it's something that as an organisation we do try to encourage.
Going back to the idea of school culture again, why is it important to pay attention to school culture?
Because I think there's always a culture in every organisation, no matter what you do, and you don't want the culture to become a bad culture. You want to try as much as possible to cultivate a positive culture. I suppose in a school, if the adults don't try and cultivate the right culture, then what tends to happen is the kids will cultivate the culture, because kids are human beings and that's what they do. And that means that they, you know, for example, they might form certain groups or there might be certain behaviours going on that you might not necessarily want. So that's, I think, you know, you need to try and push them, push everybody in a certain direction. For example, if we weren't trying to get children to say good morning on the stairs every day, then they wouldn't say good morning and it would be a very, very different feel at lesson change over time. They'd all kind of have their heads down, looking miserable or turning around and talking to each other or whatever, and that would change the whole feel of the school. I mean, that is, again, just a very small example, but it does illustrate, I think, what the broader implications of culture are.
And if a culture is, say, more negative, I mean, like, because the examples you've given so far are generally positive, like, you know, good at sports or very academic focused. But if the culture does turn negative, can that be reversed, or how easily can a school culture be changed?
Well, I don't have any personal experience of having done that myself, so there's only so far I can comment. But I've certainly seen colleagues who've gone into schools, such as Barry Smith, who's gone into Great Yarmouth Charter Academy, and he has changed the culture in that school extremely quickly, admittedly with the support of his colleagues and so on and so forth. But, you know, you can, it is possible to go into a school. Arc Elvin as well is a school in Wembley, just down the road from us, that had a certain reputation, say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and now is a school that's really changing and is flourishing and turning it around.
Can you tell us a bit about, if we go back to Barry for a minute, can you tell us a little bit about what he did or how did he change the culture of that school?
Again, I mean, I don't know the details. I wasn't there, but I suspect that it's going in, it's putting in place strong behaviour systems. It's strategically identifying what the problems are and trying to overcome those problems. I think, though, the impression I get from the thousands of positive blogs I've read and all the tweets I've read is that what he's done is he's got the staff behind him. And I think that's a really important thing. I think that's something that my boss, Catherine Berbelstein, does very well as well. I mean, obviously, we're trying to set up a culture from scratch at our school because we just opened in 2014. But Catherine really has got the staff behind her. And I think that's something that you do need. If you're going to change a culture, you need every single person in the building helping to guide the pupils and to cultivate that the culture that you want. And so people need to be invested in it.
And when you planned to address the teachers at the Research Ed conference, what message were you planning to convey to them?
So I wanted to talk about how we can change the lives of disadvantaged children without burning out all of our staff, and we can do that without it being too complicated. I mean, I think that when I first started teaching, I read all of these books from particularly American educators, such as Rafe Esquith was one, Erin Gruel, and all these people who, I mean, are absolute heroes, people I totally admire. But I mean, they work all the time, and I'm surprised they haven't got high blood pressure or whatever it may be. I mean, they're taking on extra jobs so they can buy their kids books, they're working all hours, and I think when I first taught, that was the way that I sort of felt about it, although I just simply didn't have the energy to do what they did. They're really quite exceptional people. I used to think that I'd got an early night if I'd turned my laptop off before 10:30 in my first couple of years. But I don't think that has to be the way. And I don't want us to go to the other extreme and just think, oh, well, teachers don't have to do anything, because obviously teaching is a hard job, no matter how much you try to reduce workload. But I think if you get the culture of the school right, that is, if you get children being polite to teachers, following instructions, motivated to learn, doing their homework, then that can make a teacher's life so much easier. It's so much better for your well-being, and it doesn't mean that you have to work late into the night. I mean, I think one of the best moments this year for me so far was a teacher in the English department who just started at the school in September, sort of a week or two into term, came into my office and said, I just can't believe it. Every single one of my year nines has handed in their homework. That's never happened to me before. And she just said it actually made her feel a bit emotional, because it was just this moment of, wow, what we've done, the culture at the school is such that these kids who are from some of the toughest backgrounds in the UK are doing their homework every week, you know? And there's the odd kid that doesn't do their homework, but broadly speaking, you set a homework task, you get 30 pieces of homework back. And that is amazing. And of course that makes your life easier, because you're not running around chasing the kids all the time. You're not having those confrontational arguments with them constantly. You're not having to deal with the parents all the time. And I think, you know, teachers who work really, really hard in some of the toughest schools in this country, that's what they spend all their time doing. And it's a shame that I think they burn out. And then, you know, when I was also wanted to talk about the fact that teacher retention is a real problem, that we're losing teachers. Teachers aren't staying after more than 5 years. And I think that is because you just feel, after a day in a classroom, when you're a full-time teacher, you feel like you've been beaten up. I mean, you feel like you've had more arguments in one day than most people have in a year. You have, you know, it's just exhausting just performing for the whole day. And then there's so much admin. And then your senior leader comes in and grades your lesson and says, actually, you're not good enough. And then tells you to go and enter a ton of data that doesn't really mean anything and nobody will look at or use anyway. I mean, it's soul-destroying. No wonder people leave their jobs so early on in their careers, leave teaching so early on in their careers, and go and take an office job where actually 9 to 5 means 9 to 5 and where you get an hour for lunch. Not surprised.
What kind of data are you expected to complete? Because we hear in Ireland a lot about the amount of paperwork that is wrapped up in teaching in the UK. So can you just give us an idea of what's involved?
I mean, it's actually quite hard to say. I think, look, we do use data at Michaela, obviously, but I think some schools, they want to be able to show progress. And so they want teachers to be marking a substantial piece of summative work fairly frequently and then entering whatever the data for that is into some sort of spreadsheet. And then often, you know, if you have any position of responsibility, whether that means you're a head of subject department or if you're a second in charge of a department or at a higher level, there's a heck of a lot of analysis that goes with that. So, you know, for example, you need to find out how many pupils are passing, but also, you know, what percentage of boys are passing versus girls, what percentage of children with special needs are passing versus non-special needs. And then it's not just passing, it's are they making progress against their target grade, against their baseline, against their predicted grades. And then, of course, the other layer is whether or not they're technically disadvantaged pupil, i.e. they're in receipt of additional funding for having been from a disadvantaged background, which we call pupil premium. So if they're a pupil premium child, you're measuring the progress of those children, which is just a phenomenal amount of time spent on something that actually just tells you something that any good teacher will probably be able to tell you by looking at the class anyway. He doesn't get it, she does, he's struggling, I need to see her after school because she's really far behind because she was absent yesterday. I mean, any good teacher knows that anyway, and I think we don't rely enough on teacher intuitions, and instead we want to see numbers, we want to see proof, because we don't trust teachers enough to be able to make judgments about their kids. And I think, you know, a good example of silly data that I can tell you is seating plans, I think, is a really interesting one. So this strikes me as the most utterly pointless thing that anyone in a school has ever been asked to do, which is to create a seating plan of their class, but to then annotate that seating plan with the various needs of each child on it. So colour coding it, putting their target grades on there, and then using that seating plan to inform your differentiation and your planning and so on. Again, I think a teacher that knows their class well will do that without having to have it on this crazy seating plan. And then the thing is, you know, one lesson, little Jimmy's playing up, and so you need to move him a seat, and then what? You have to go home that night and recreate your seating plan. So it's just, it just creates, it's very small things that over time accumulate to create a lot of extra work. You know, another thing as well is extensive marking. I mean, we do believe in marking at Michaela. We do mark children's work. You need to see what they've done. I think it's the best way, particularly in English, to be able to see into a child's mind to understand how well have they understood these ideas and how well can they articulate them. So you do need to mark their work, but you don't need to write a comment on every single kid's work, and then they don't need to respond to that comment, and then you should go back and respond to the comment, which I think is what's happening in a lot of schools. I know that broadly speaking that is changing now. Lots of schools are becoming more sensible on that, but I'm sure it is still happening. And I think, you know, coming back to those American teachers that I mentioned earlier, Rafe Esquith and so on, is that there is a little bit of a martyr complex. And I don't know whether teachers are doing this intentionally, but I think when you really care about the kids and when you really want them to succeed, senior leaders in particular will encourage their teachers to work so hard because, you know, they say, well, look, we're doing it for the kids. We need to work hard for the kids. But I just don't think that's necessarily the case. I do think that obviously we want to get these kids to achieve amazing things, but it doesn't mean we should all be killing ourselves to do it. And so we just have to be smart and we have to think sensibly about what we want.
And you've hardly even mentioned the planning that goes into, or the paperwork that goes into planning and preparation for
that's
teaching.
That's right. And I mean, what we've done at Michaela is we centralise a lot of planning. So, I mean, I say centralised planning, but in fact, we create a resource that everyone can use, but then all you have to do essentially is look through that resource and think about how you're going to tweak it for your class because you know your class well. So I remember again from my first few years of teaching, and this is something I see in my colleagues who are teaching now in other schools, who say things to me like, oh God, I don't know what I'm teaching tomorrow. I've got no idea what to do. Or I've got to start teaching, I don't know, Pride and Prejudice next week and I haven't even read it before. So what am I going to do? I've got to go away this weekend and read the whole book. And obviously you should read a book before you teach it, but you should spend your time thinking about how you're going to make that, how you're going to differentiate it for your class, how you're going to get every single child in your class, the kids that you know, that you have a relationship with, to understand it, rather than thinking, what is the sequence of learning? What are the main ideas that I need to teach? What are the practice activities? I know in maths that this is the maths teacher's perennial challenge, is that if you have to teach a concept, you then have to sit there and write 60, 100, 150 questions for the kids to practice. Well, if all of those questions are at least pre-planned in a sort of school-created textbook, then at least you've got something to work with, and then you can pick and choose, well, actually, we won't do questions 1 to 10 because they're too easy for this class, but we will do 20 to 50 because those are right at the right level for this class. And actually, some kids at the really top, real top of that class might be able to start at questions 15 to, I don't know, whatever. I mean, I'm not a maths teacher, so don't quote me on that, but that's the kind of thing that we have in mind, is that teachers having something to work with, so reduce their time planning, and then they can spend more time thinking about how they're going to get their kids to learn.
Katie, you've mentioned your own school, Michaela Community School, a few times. Can you tell us a little bit about that school so that we kind of get an idea of the context that you work in?
Of course. So we are a free school, which means that we are not managed by the local authority. We're kind of an independent, but we are still a state school, so we are directly accountable to central government. We're funded by them in the same way, and we take pupils via the same admissions criteria, so we're not selective. We're in Wembley, which is one of the most disadvantaged areas in London. Our children come from a wide variety of cultural and socioeconomic backgrounds, and we opened in 2014, so we're just going into our first GCSE year this year. So yeah, we're quite different to other schools. Because we were able to start from scratch, we were really able to set the culture from the start. So we wanted to have a fairly traditional school where the teacher is the authority in the classroom, in the sense that they are the fountain of knowledge. They are the person that can teach the children what they need to know, and then the children can practice it. That depends obviously on children being well behaved, but we don't just want behaviour for the sake of compliance. We want behaviour, strong behaviour systems, and children to behave well because we want them to become good people. So it's not just about the obviously the academic side of the school is very important, because we recognise that children from disadvantaged backgrounds, their lives will be improved enormously if they are able to get great grades at GCSE and beyond. But we also want them to be good people. We want them to be polite people who smile and say good morning and who can sit up straight and make good eye contact and shake someone's hand with confidence, who will come across well in a job interview, who are kind to other people, who are, you know, selfless and just are in good habits of character as well as habits of mind and intellect.
And when you say that the teacher is the authority, what was the thinking behind that idea? Because there's a lot of talk about, you know, children being partners and democratic schooling and so on. So I'm just curious about why that was chosen.
All of the teachers that were involved in setting up the school have kind of combined their years of experience to think about what to them has worked best. And again, I think that's something that schools don't often do enough, which is just listen to their teachers and think, well, what do the teachers reckon works most? But it's not just that. It's our experiences, but it's also looking at some of the research that's out there. And the fact is that there is a lot of evidence to show that, you know, more direct teaching has a greater impact on pupil results than the discovery sort of approach, where children discover things for themselves. And that's not to say that every single piece of evidence of education research that's out there we should listen to and change our approaches accordingly. I think, you know, you have to use your common sense when you listen to research. But I think on the sort of wider level, the broader level of how to teach, should you get children to learn things through discovery or should you tell them things, that is where research is helpful. That doesn't mean, of course, that you should only tell them things and that they should never be encouraged to think. We're somewhat in the middle of those two extremes, I think, and most people are, to be fair. It is a spectrum. We do want to encourage children to be thinking and manipulating what they've been taught and putting it into their own contexts, linking it to other contexts and so on and so forth, as much as we can, because that's the route to really deep understanding of what they've been taught. But I think in the first place, when the content is first delivered to the child, somebody who's an expert at understanding that content needs to be the person to tell them what it is, and then they can go away and manipulate it themselves.
What age group are the students in your school?
11 to 16 at the moment, but we will be opening a sixth form next year, which means that we'll be 11 to 18.
So you actually started off then with the 11-year-olds,
yes.
And then they have worked through. So you know, so the students that are there have been there from the start.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a really brilliant opportunity to just have one year group's worth of kids and to take them up all the way through. Yeah.
And were you there from the start?
Yes, I was.
And on next week's programme, Katie Ashford will tell us what it was like setting up a school from scratch. Katie is deputy head teacher at Michaela Community School in Wembley Park in London. Katie tweets with the hashtag Katie_S_Ashford. Remember, you can listen to or download any of over 340 previous episodes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. If you're looking for ideas for a present for yourself or for a teacher you know, check out my book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have. It's available on online bookstores and directly from the publisher Routledge. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.